Welcome to our panel this morning, Who Lost Russia and How Did It Happen? This is panel 5009 on Friday, April 13th at 9 a.m. And we have with us Professor Jeffrey Engel from Southern Methodist University, who will be giving some introductory comments for about 10 to 15 minutes. I may pose a couple of general questions, and then we'll leave lots of time in this session for audience questions, because we have one speaker who's very generously agreed to answer as many questions as we can get to this morning. We'll leave lots of time for questions. I'm Sarah Soke. I'm a professor in the political science department. My area of expertise is in Russian politics, so I'm very excited to hear what Dr. Engel has to say this morning. So just as a brief means of introduction before I turn this over, Jeffrey Engel is the director of the Center for Presidential History, and I believe the founding director, is
yes.
That correct, for the Center for Presidential History at Southern Methodist University, and has a long and illustrious academic career. Has been educated at Cornell, at Oxford. His PhD is from the University of Wisconsin, has spent time at Yale, and has authored and edited 12 books on American foreign policy. His most recent book, which is on sale at the table just outside of this panel, is this very interesting book, When the World Seemed New, George H.W. Bush and the End of the Cold War. And so I would encourage you to take a look at this on the table outside of the panel. He uses previously classified documents that we didn't have access to before, is my understanding, and interviews to look at crucial turning points in George H.W. Bush's administration and foreign policy choices, and also has a current book project that I think is not published yet, but you may want to ask him questions about, which is about impeachment, so presidential impeachment.
No reason
based on current events, yeah. But an edited collection that we'll look at Andrew Johnson, Nixon, Clinton, and the history of impeachment in the American presidency. So lots of interesting things to talk about. Thank you very much for being here this morning. And I'll turn it over now to Dr. Engel.
Great. Well, thank you. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. They asked me to sit, but I'm actually going to walk around just because it's 9 o'clock, and then I'll come back for the conversation. I need to get my blood moving as well. Thank you all for coming out this morning so early to talk about something that in no way, shape, or form has been in the headlines at all. And of course, I joke because this is really a fundamentally important question for the United States. That is, what happened at the end of the Cold War? What happened at this halcyonic, optimistic moment 25 years ago when we thought the world was all going to turn democratic, including our greatest adversary, the Soviet Union? And yet we have, within the last several weeks, and several months, as you know, nothing but news of antagonism between the United States and Russia. So much so, Sarah and I were joking, sardonically, a little bit before, that Vladimir Putin, in his last State of His Union address, decided to give a visual demonstration of the computer-generated, of the prowess of Soviet nuclear weapons, and just out of coincidence happened to use Florida as a target. Now, I have to point out, as a student of American politics, given the last couple of elections, perhaps losing Florida would not be the worst thing. But it certainly got our attention, and that was the point of it. So I want to go back and talk a little bit about how it is that we got to this place of antagonism, because I think the roots really are at the end of the Cold War. And in fact, you have to go back even further than the end of the Cold War to ask why the Cold War itself ended. And it ended fundamentally because of one man. That is, because of Mikhail Gorbachev, who was, of course, the Soviet leader who comes to power in 1985, who is that remarkably unusual politician of any stripe, because not only did he recognize a problem, he was willing to do something about it. I mean, most just recognized the problem. And the problem was that the Soviet economy basically was faltering. After oil shocks and after the oil collapse of the 1970s, the Soviets basically realized, and when I say the Soviets, I mean all Soviet leaders of any stripe, recognized their economy simply wasn't keeping up with the West. It wasn't producing as much as the West, and by the West, I mean Western Europe in particular. It wasn't producing the kind of civil society they wanted, and it certainly wasn't producing the kind of economic and productivity that would allow them to keep up, again, with Western Europe in particular. And this had been going on for frankly, for decades. In fact, the best way to understand what happened and the sort of the sense of the Soviet economy at this time is represented by the following joke, which is that Stalin, Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, Soviet premier during the 1950s, and Brezhnev, Soviet leader during the 70s, are all riding in a train car together, and the train stops. And they look at each other, and as good Soviet leaders, they say, how can we get this thing moving again? And Stalin obviously goes first. That's his style. And he says, well, it's very easy. All we do is round up all the peasants from a local village, shoot half of them, and the other half will be really incentivized to get moving. And they discuss the merits of this, maybe it's good or bad, at which point Khrushchev says, no, comrades, it's much easier than that. All we need to do is just denounce the previous train driver. At which point Brezhnev, and this is the key to the story, Brezhnev says, no, comrades, it's much, much easier than that. All we need to do is pull down the shades, rock back and forth, and pretend we're still moving. That is the Soviet economy by the 70s and 80s. But Gorbachev comes in promising three things in order to alter the Soviet situation, two of which I suspect you've heard of. The first, of course, is perestroika. That is to say, a general reforming and restructuring of Soviet society. The next is glasnost, or a general openness to new ideas in particular, so that we didn't get stuck in dogma. And then a third that I think is actually the most important, the least well-known, which is Gorbachev begins increasingly to talk about the formation of a common European home. The idea being that if the Soviets decrease their aggressive posture, increase their good ties with the rest of the world, decrease their military spending in particular, which he thought they couldn't afford anyway, they wanted to put it back into industrial development. Essentially, if they became, instead of an angry Soviet bear, a cuddly Soviet bear, that this would allow for the formation of what Europe and Russian minds had always been designed to be, which was a club including them. You know that one of the key issues in Russian history, of course, is whether or not the Russians are, in fact, European or Asian. The answer to this largely determines upon where you're sitting at the time. That is, if you're sitting in Moscow, almost invariably, the answer is yes, we're European. If you're sitting in Paris or Berlin, the answer is typically, we'd rather not talk about that question. And consequently, Gorbachev thought that he could, in fact, use this new Soviet approach to fuse the Soviet Union, a reformed Soviet Union, with a reformed and a vitalized Western Europe, get rid of the East-West divide, if you will, and that ugly Cold War structure that separated Europe at its heart, and therefore move into the 21st century more productively, more cooperatively, more peacefully in a common European home, essentially to join Europe. And keep in mind, this is the very moment when the European Union is actually coming into official formation. So the idea of supranational entities is actually a very vibrant one within the international community. Why does this matter? Because it goes terribly wrong. It goes terribly wrong for the Russians on many levels. And particularly, it goes terribly wrong for the Russians, I would argue, in large part because of the American reaction. The American reaction to this idea of a common European home, in many ways, is one of terror, which is to say, the problem with a common European home, from the George Bush perspective, H.W. Bush, the senior Bush, is that it doesn't include an American wing. There's no place in the architecture of a common European home for the United States. And in fact, Bush and those around him start to believe and start to worry that if the Soviets do this incredibly unexpected thing of actually getting the Western Europeans to buy that their reform is legitimate, then the Western Europeans might drop their defenses and might even worse, might say to the Americans, thank you for your service, it's time to go home after World War II. And this violated the central tenet, if you will, of American foreign policy from 1945, I would argue up until right until the current administration, which was that the basic purpose for the United States in Europe was to keep it peaceful. And in fact, you have to go back to a more meta reading of European history from the American perspective, which is that the real problem with Europe, geopolitically, is that it's filled with Europeans. And because Europeans have this nasty habit every 20 years or so of trying to kill each other. And in fact, in World War I, they almost got there. We came over and saved the day, and then being good Americans, we went home. Again, this is the American reading of history. In the Second World War, we had to go back and do it again. And that time, we got it right. That is to say, that time, we stayed. Guess what? There hasn't been a war since in Europe. And consequently, for American policymakers, there really was little concern to find out whether this was correlation or causation. They thought it too dangerous to try to remove the Americans from the equation, which is ultimately what Gorbachev's plan, had it been successful, they believed would do. What this means, therefore, is that when the Cold War ends in remarkably unexpected ways, and when I say remarkably unexpected ways, please keep in mind, there was no decision made, for example, to open the Berlin Wall. It was done purely by accident. Now, by the way, I'm seeing skeptical looks in your eyes. That's good, because it's almost impossible to fathom that the most important geopolitical event of the last 35 years happened by accident, but it's true. I'll tell you the story real briefly. East German crowds, like many crowds in Europe and Poland and Hungary and other places, have been marching, asking for democratic reforms. In particular, in East Germany, they were marching in October of 1989, largely asking for the power to leave. But then in October, something happened in the East German crowd that changed the equation entirely. They began to argue not just for democratic reforms and not for the right to leave. Those East German crowds began to argue, we are the people and we are staying. That was terrifying to the East German conservative communist regime, because that meant that those people were going to make them change. Change was not something that that regime was particularly interested in fomenting. Consequently, the regime, in reaction, begins a series of, shall we say, opening gestures, friendly gestures towards its own people. Different reforms, talking about the fact that, yes, we'll think about holding elections. Yes, we'll think about trying to get more public participation in the government. Yes, in fact, we will talk someday about increasing travel for East Germans, which had long been an issue, obviously. This came to a head on the evening of November 9th, 1989, when the East German spokesperson, by the way, a position that hadn't existed 2 weeks before, one of the reforms they thought would be helpful was if we had somebody actually going out and talking to the people for the East German's government. The East German spokesperson, before going to his nightly news conference, stopped by the Politburo simply to say, is there anything new you want me to know? At which point he is handed a file of papers and told, this is the new travel regulation that is going to go into effect sometime in the future. Don't talk about it. It's embargoed. And the travel regulation essentially boils down to this. If East German citizens ask for the right to leave, we'll consider it. That was a big step. He shoves it into his briefcase and goes to the press conference and then proceeds to give the most boring two-hour press conference you can ever imagine. So boring that I encourage you to go on YouTube and watch it and count the number of journalists who fall asleep. At which point, at the end of 2 hours, an Italian journalist finally raises his hand and says, I have a question. Do you have anything up for us on travel? At which point, the gentleman reaches into his briefcase and says, yes, I do, forgetting that this was embargoed, and proceeds to say, in essence, the new travel regulation is that anybody who wants to go can. Okay, then. And if you want to see the look of terror in a person's eyes, look at the expression on his face when he looks up and realizes what he thought was an innocuous message suddenly caused pandemonium in the room, and this was being televised. What that meant, in essence, was that people around the country, especially those in East Germany who had a habit of watching West German television, knew immediately, because of breaking news, you're allowed to go. The wall is open. Freedom is just around the corner, literally, for those people. At which point, crowds began to gather at the Berlin Wall, where they confronted guards who, of course, had no orders to let them go. This is a very dangerous situation. Made all the more dangerous, I'll remind you, by two factors. The first is that those East German guards had standing orders to shoot, to kill anyone who tried to cross the border. The second being that about 50 yards away was an American tank and squadron, which was typically there just to be there, but I assure you was fully armed. Keep those two facts in mind. Consequently, when the crowd begins to agitate to say, let us go, let us go, the commanders become very agitated themselves. They do what all good East German officers do. They call for confirmation. They call into central headquarters to say, what about these new travel regulations? And are immediately told, there are no new travel regulations. At which point, after about a half an hour of back and forth, the gentleman on the other end of the phone tells the commander at the key checkpoint, the Braunstrasse checkpoint, tells him, maybe you're just too scared to do what you know you need to do. Maybe you're chicken. And he hangs up the phone. Now, the person he was talking to, the colonel he was talking to, actually had been in the Border Guards for 30 years, and he wore on his lapel the insignia that suggested, not just suggested, that proved that he had been a person capable of shooting to kill. He had done so in the past when somebody tries to cross the border. And he also had another interesting aspect to his life, which is that he was scheduled to go to the doctor the next day, where he was expecting the doctors would confirm that their latest round of tests would tell him that the cancer he had was incurable and terminal. And I like to think at that moment he realized that he was going to meet his maker probably sooner than he expected or desired, and he wanted not to have to answer what happened next, what could have happened next. So consequently, he says, open the gates, people flood through, at which point everything's televised. Once one gate open, all the other gates open, and that's the end of the Berlin Wall. By the way, parenthetically, I should mention this important colonel is still alive today, which tells you everything you need to know about the accuracy of East German doctors. But the reason I tell this story is to give a sense of the anxiety at this moment that people around the world, whether they are in Washington, George Bush, whether they're in London, Margaret Thatcher, whether they're in France, François Mitterrand, or in the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, didn't know what was going on because none of this was planned. And because none of this was planned, the next question that arose was one that they've been trying to avoid for 40-odd years, which was, what do we do with this Germany place? Because remember, Germany had been divided since 1945, and I guarantee you that nobody in Europe outside of Germany was looking forward to that band getting back together again. Because the last time they had been together, it hadn't been so good for the rest of the continent. And in fact, in London, in Paris, in Moscow, leadership was deeply opposed to the idea of German unification. Only in the United States was a Western leader in favor of unification. Why is that? Well, because George Bush saw it as a way to resolve the central strategic quandary of the common European home. Because he cut a deal, and when I say cut a deal, it was on a walk, one-on-one at Camp David, with Helmut Kohl. Parenthetically, picture Helmut Kohl for a second. I hope you're picturing a very hefty gentleman. And note that George Bush cut this deal on a walk. I better refer to as a hike, at which point I think Kohl would have agreed to anything, just to end a hike. It gets Kohl to agree to the following, which is that we, the United States, will support unification in one condition. And that condition is you must have unified Germany remain a full member of NATO. Because NATO was our calling card and our invitation to be in Europe, Bush believed. And NATO can't exist without a functioning Germany. Germany is the largest manpower provider, it's the second largest financial provider, and it's where all the good bases are as well. NATO will collapse without Germany. Consequently, Bush says this is the only thing that I require, and I will in fact use my levers of power over the French, over the British, over the Soviets to get them to agree with me that we should allow Germany to be unified in NATO. Now keep in mind, this is really an open question at the time. It's hard to remember, but we have one half of Germany that was in NATO already, West Germany, one half of Germany, East Germany, that was in the Warsaw Pact. So it was not out of the realm of possibility that this new unified country that, by the way, did I mention nobody was really enthused about, that this new unified country would perhaps become neutral, which would kill NATO, among other things, leaving Europe to the Soviets from Bush's perspective. Bush manages to get the British and the French on board. He has levers of power over both of them. And then he ultimately gets the Soviets on board as well. And he gets them on board essentially with two promises. The first is, we will give you lots of economic aid because we know this transition you're going to make from communism to capitalism is quite literally unprecedented. And that the Soviet people are going to suffer no matter what, we will help to alleviate or at least ameliorate the suffering. The second thing he promises is much more important and much more complex. He, represented by his Secretary of State, James Baker, in February of 1990, essentially promises Gorbachev, and essentially is really quite an important word, essentially promises Gorbachev that NATO will not expand, as he put it, 1 inch to the east, meaning 1 inch to the east of, at that point, the center line of Germany. Now, you ask yourself, how does that work? how does Germany remain half in NATO and half in nothing? Well, pretty soon they recognize that that's silly. So, Article 5 of NATO regulations, which require people to choose an attack upon one, view an attack upon one as an attack upon all, doesn't work if you are only willing to draw a different line than a border within your country. So consequently, the line begins to move to the east. And in fact, Gorbachev accepts this initial offer that NATO will not move one inch to the east, because remember, from the Russian perspective, NATO moving to the east means essentially the Western military security blanket moving closer to their border. By the way, keep in mind, this is a border that is only open because the Soviets had started a process of reform to try to make a more peaceful world. Gorbachev would allow this. In fact, Gorbachev says a very interesting thing to James Baker at that point. He says, you know, maybe we should join NATO too, the Soviet Union. Keep in mind, this is 1990. There are still a whole lot of nuclear weapons and tanks pointed at each other from both sides. He says, maybe we should join NATO too, and NATO should be how we go forward altogether. Baker is a very good lawyer, which means he does not answer that question. He says, that's really interesting. We can revisit that in 30 or 40 years as things start to move and the common European home works, as you are fully accepted and acceptable, in essence. Here is the root of a problem. This deal that Baker cut with Gorbachev was just as I described it to you. In fact, literally as I described it to you, because there was no literally, it was orally given. It was never written down. And Baker, being a good lawyer, recognized that if something is not written down, it doesn't exist. And if it's not codified in treaty, subsequent administrations cannot possibly be bound by an oral commitment given offhand, perhaps, by an American Secretary of State from a previous administration. And consequently, subsequent administrations, the Clinton administration and the George W. Bush administration, oversee the expansion of NATO to the east, into places that not only used to be part of the Soviet bloc, but used to be part of the Soviet Union in many cases itself. In essence, look at it from the Russian perspective, having dropped their arms, the enemy moved closer. A second thing occurred, which is the economy got as bad as people expected. The standard of living for a Russian citizen in the mid-1990s was, I have trouble describing just how horrible it was. Every metric you could come up with shows that it was terrible. Standard of living goes down, birth rates go down, infant mortality goes up, alcoholism goes up. In fact, if you just want to do a caloric count, the caloric count for Russians, the average Russian in the mid-1990s, was less than it had been in 1917. So the entire 20th century, in many ways, had been for naught from the Soviet perspective and then from the Russian perspective. And this allowed the political turmoil that ensued as a country tries to transform from communism autocracy to democracy, and as a country tries to form from capitalism, transform into, or excuse me, from communism into capitalism, this allowed a genuine, shall we say, unease with democratic and Western institutions to fester. A festering that I argue was ultimately capitalized upon by a man in the news today, a certain Vladimir Putin. Not alone, but exceptionally so, of Vladimir Putin, who had firsthand knowledge of what it looked like when a communist state collapsed. He was actually stationed in East Germany, in Dresden, when the wall comes down. And in fact, Putin had a particularly interesting and important experience when the wall came down. He was the KGB station chief, in Dresden. And after the wall came down, many, if not most, East German cities found their Stasi headquarters, their secret police headquarters, ransacked and burned by angry citizens. This also happened to many KGB outlets as well. Everybody knew where they were, but not in Dresden. Why? Because Vladimir Putin, when the crowd arrived at his doorstep, and this is a German crowd, so I typically picture them with pitchforks and torches, when they arrive and they say, "Let us in, we want to destroy the place," Putin orders his troops to the back of the house and tells them to do two things. The first is barricade yourselves in, and the second is call for reinforcements. He then goes to the front of the house, puts on a sidearm, opens the door, looks at the crowd, and tells the crowd to go away. Now, I want you to think about this image. You have a crowd of several hundred, and you have one small man with a pistol, and suddenly the crowd realizes, we don't like our odds. They look into his eyes, and they went away. Putin closes the door, locks it, goes to the back, and says to his troops, okay, we have a few minutes before they probably come back. When are the reinforcements coming? At which point, he's told they're not. Why? Well, the exact phrase he heard was, Moscow is silent. That is to say, they are not even willing, these new democratically inspired leaders, to protect their own soldiers in the field, to protect the people they had put out to defend their national interest. Putin takes from this lesson in the general disillusionment of Eastern Europe and of Eastern Germany in particular, the lesson that democracies are weak and that democracies will fail when pressed because the democratic leadership of his own country had just done so. Moreover, he comes to a conclusion upon reviewing the record and thinking about the way the end of the Cold War worked. First, that this was a tremendous geopolitical tragedy for the Soviet Union and for the world. But secondly, that the Americans had lied. Why? Well, NATO moved east and we were promised it wouldn't. If you go into essentially try to unpack Putin's ideas of why we need to be antagonistic towards the West, it basically comes down to two fundamental points. The first is the Americans lied about NATO, and look at the economic and political turmoil that occurred afterwards that they told us they were going to ameliorate. And they are so powerful, more than ameliorate, it's probably their fault. They're probably punishing us for trying to stand up to them for all those years. And consequently, when Putin comes into power in 2000, having worked his way behind the scenes, if you will, up the food chain, removing a man, or shall we say, dismissing a man in many ways, Boris Yeltsin, who had come to epitomize the inability of democracies to get things done in Russia, he promises the Russian people, we will be strong, and strong in ways you can hold. We will stand up to the West that had lied to us. And more importantly, we will stand up to them because all the problems you have are their fault. And you know what happens over the next few years? The Russian economy starts to get better. And Russian politics start to become more stable. You can imagine why they start to become more stable under Vladimir Putin. Opposition leaders tend to have a short lifespan. Moreover, the economy begins to go, I would argue, because the general world economy begins to uptick at that point, and the Soviets are, and the Russians, excuse me, are finally able to join the internet revolution, if you will. But from the Russian perspective, by I mean the average citizen, Vladimir Putin came in and said, we're going to be tough and we're going to stand up to the West, and we got our lives looking better and better every day. Now, that's not necessarily the case today. That is to say, the economic sanctions that we have imposed, by we I mean the Western community, for Russia's, shall we say, nefarious dealings, whether they're in Crimea or whether they're in different parts and different suburbs of London, those have taken a bite out of the Russian economy and out of the Russian people. But the general, shall we say, nationalist narrative still holds. That is to say, for Putin and for those around him who believe in a strong Russia, who believe in a strong country, and who believe in a strong stability-based economy and political system, the antithesis of this is the West and democratic institutions, which are weak, and here's the fun part, can be weakened further. And I think that's probably a good place to stop, and we can talk about that going forward.
Great, so thank you very much. I think we do have a lot to talk about, and I'm sure many questions as well from the audience. So in this session, as in other sessions you may have attended, we'll use both the CWA app, so I have my laptop here that I'll be seeing your questions come in on, and a note card system as well to receive questions from the audience. So to ask a question in the app, you can simply select this session in the schedule and tap Q&A, and then insert and send your question. You can also raise your hand to request a note card and pencil from one of our producers. We do ask, they officially have on the sheet here that I ask you to write legibly, which will be helpful for me too. If you're a student, please note that in your question. And they do ask as well that the questions remain brief and to the point. So as I wait for some questions to come in, I see some people getting note cards there, and I'll see them come in on the app as well. I have plenty of questions to ask, although I'll try to restrict myself to just a couple at the beginning here.
You're an equal expert in this area, so please.
Which means that I have all the more questions that I could dominate the conversation with, but I won't. So one question that I'm especially interested in is something that we talked about briefly before the panel began, which is that there's a historian at Tufts University, Chris Miller, who's recently made this comparison between the Putin era and the Brezhnev era. And you use this, I love the train story, right, of the different ways that the leaders of the Soviet Union would deal with the train. And so the Brezhnev answer is, we pretend the train is still moving. And the comparison here is that Putin has been in power for 18 years. The economy initially did better under Putin in the early 2000s. And then more recently, though, it has not. And the Russian economy has been stagnating since the 2008-2009 financial crisis in many ways. There's been a slight recovery, but standards of living are still stagnating. Conditions in healthcare are not going very well. Education is undersupported and underfunded. Unemployment is still higher than people would like. Sanctions have not been the main reason for Russians' problems, but they certainly don't help anything. And so my question is, I'm wondering what you think of this comparison. Is the Putin era like the Brezhnev era? Is it this long-standing stagnation that's a setup for the beginning of the end?
You know, it's a great question and a great analogy. And we have to thank Chris for suggesting it, I think, because it's actually pretty apt on two levels, it strikes me, on the economic and on the geostrategic, if you will. On the economic level, I think we are seeing stagnation, as you described, though the 50s actually were a time, if you will, of great Soviet progress. But nonetheless, it was not a time of openness of discussion in many ways. I might say the 70s are closer to today for the Russians. And in fact, one of the reasons I think is actually quite important for other issues I'm sure are going to come up in our discussion of Russia, which is that it is very easy, if you control all the outlets of media in your country, to control the narrative of your country. Let me ask you all a metaphysical question. How do you know what the unemployment rate is in the United States? The government tells us, or at the very least, you hear it on NPR. And consequently, I did not go out and measure everybody. You did not go out and measure everybody. We just believe that that's the number. So if you are not willing to give people accurate numbers, you can go for a long time getting them to think that their world exists in a certain particular way. Now, it might be that the average Russian says to themselves, I haven't seen any of my neighbors get jobs, and I haven't seen any of my standard of living go up, but maybe I'm the exception. Maybe I just need to work harder, or maybe it's the American's fault. So there is that control of information that's important. There's also a second way in which I think Khrushchev is particularly apt, because Khrushchev was particularly good at getting the world to respect a level of Russian power that didn't necessarily exist. Let's say, remember, Nikita Khrushchev is the Russian leader who went to the United Nations, pounded his shoe on the table and said, we will churn out missiles like sausages. Turns out there weren't that many sausages. And in fact, one of the interesting questions was how that we discovered in when the archives open is just how thoroughly the Eisenhower administration knew, because of overflights, because of spying, because of U-2 missions, etc., knew that the Soviets didn't have that many sausages. But they couldn't reveal that information because then they would have to reveal how they got that information, and that would ruin the program. So the world kept believing that there are a lot of sausages, because I have not counted the number of Soviet missiles, neither have you as an average citizen in the 1950s. So therefore, I think the Brezhnev comparison there is really apt, because if Putin blusters, and especially blusters about military affairs, in particular, let's say, about reconstituting his nuclear force, about creating these wonderful new smart missiles that can take out Western Florida at a drop of a hat, who are we to know in many ways? Because if we did find out that was not true, our government found that out, I would hope they wouldn't tell us. Because if our government had that good information, the United States government, on the actual lethality of Russian nuclear programming, that's pretty good information. I'd rather they kept those chains of information open rather than telling the public and watching those chains of information get cut off. So Putin, in a sense, like Brezhnev, is willing and able to punch above his weight, if you will, rhetorically.
I think that's a a very interesting answer, sort of about where, what direction we might be headed in, and how Russians might interpret what happens, right? So are things getting better, and how do you know if things are getting better? And that relates well to several questions that have come in as you were talking. One is about generally how the Russian economy can be improved now, but several questions address this issue of sort of how the Russian economy can be improved. If oil prices decline, as some people think that they will, that would hurt the Russian economy a lot. So if things get worse, what happens? And what happens in 2024? So Putin has just been elected for another 6-year term. So what happens looking forward with the Russian economy, do you think? We're asking you to predict the future here a bit, but what happens in 2024? And sort of more broadly, kind of if Russia's been lost, how can it be found, right? So I think this looking forward theme.
Yeah, let me first take a step back and talk for a moment about the notion of who lost Russia. For me, it's a insider historian joke in many ways, because the mantra for the 1950s for the anti-communist movement that spawned Joseph McCarthy and Richard Nixon, among others, was the question, who lost China? Because China had been our long-term ally, and then in 1949, of course, Mao Zedong's communist forces took over. And for most policymakers in Washington, they couldn't fathom that this was some sort of indigenous civil war that had just been won by the wrong side. It had to be a failure on our part. Let's say we had control over China, this billion-person country. Consequently, when they went the wrong way, it's our fault. And I think the same question as on a big level is worth asking about Russia. That is to say, when we ask what we can do, what the West can do, what sanctions might do, et cetera, first and foremost, we have to remember that the people who have the greatest amount of control over what happens in Russia are the Russians. So let's address those two questions in reverse order. First, on the question of whether I expect Vladimir Putin to continue to be president after his next term expires, yes. I find that this element of the Russian Constitution is written in very faint pencil. And even if he's not in charge, he will still be as he was, I would argue, under Medvedev, the man behind the power, the man who's really in charge. But secondly, to the question of what can the Russians do or what might happen to improve the Russian economy, here is where the rubber meets the road for Putin. It's not about whether we can pressure him militarily, whether we can pressure him politically or in any other form, whether we raise our moral indignation about the Russians and that somehow makes them stop. What's really affecting Russia at this point, and what's really going to get Putin's attention, and what did get Putin's attention after 2013, are the bond markets. Because after the invasion of Crimea in 2013, the real hit to the Russian economy came not from sanctions, not from condemnation, but because investors wide around the world pulled out. Because you had to recognize, if this man was willing to do this on the international stage, and I'm an international company, I feel less and less confident that my property can't be taken over at any particular moment. That the country had become, if you will, too much of a unsafe, unsecured kleptocracy for me as a Western banker to want to invest. So this puts Putin in a box, because the only way to get the bonds to return and to get the bankers to return and the corporations to return and to get the economy moving with outside investment is to stop doing all the things that got him to power in the first place. He has to, if you will, become quiet on the international stage to allow stability to, over time, creep back in. Putin is much quieter in many ways than Donald Trump. I encourage you to look at their debating Twitter feeds. Putin doesn't have one. Sometimes I mention that and people applaud. He has essentially a Twitter feed that puts out standard press releases from the government. He's able to talk loudly in other ways, but for the Russian economy to further reintegrate into the global economy, he has to make Russia appear less bellicose, so he has to do the same. So he has to, for example, not hit the nationalist button that is so effective for his reelection and so effective for his power base. I'm not sure he's capable of doing that or that he really wants to do that.
Thank you. And so we have another area of questions that I think a number of you probably would be interested in, which are related to Ukraine and Crimea. And so one of these questions is about if Ukraine kind of serves as a middle point between the East and the West, but then we also have questions about what should the U.S. be doing about Crimea as well. One person has noted that there's a difference here between places like Kazakhstan or the Central Asian countries getting independence, whereas Crimea was historically part of Russia, and so that Americans are often kind of shocked that Russia had this claim to Crimea, but it's not shocking to Russians that they had this claim, perhaps. So maybe you could comment a bit on how Ukraine plays into all of this and the Russian involvement there, to put it mildly.
It's obviously a great and big and pressing question, and I think it forces us to ask, both as Americans and as members of NATO and as members of a broader international community, what is the real end game for the United States and others in Crimea and in Ukraine? My answer is that our end game is that it doesn't get worse. And in fact, that we essentially recognize the places in the world that matter to us and the places in the world that don't. Can I have a show of hands in this room of who would like themselves to go fight, or who would like their kids or grandkids to go fight and come back in a box for Crimea? I'm seeing a lot of shaking heads, but no hands. Would you be willing to go and fight for France? Well, you might get a better reaction. France is probably the wrong example sometimes. How about Britain? The point is, we have allies and we have strategic interests that are our long-term strategic interests. Places like Crimea, formerly in the Russian orbit, have never been them. And this is the real question we have to ask about NATO expansion, because NATO expansion has essentially forced the hand of subsequent administrations, probably, forced the hands of subsequent administrations to defend borders that are pre-negotiated. That is to say, it's a different question if Ukraine or Crimea or even Georgia gets attacked by the Russians than a Poland or a Hungary. Why? Because they are in NATO. And we have pledged that if they are attacked, that means we are attacked. Now, I say pledged. I would not give this current administration a great rate so far, a great mark so far, for demonstrating to the world a willingness to uphold previous administrations' pledges. But this is a big one. So we essentially have no choice in many ways but to defend those areas that NATO has expanded to. And I think our best move at this point is twofold. The first is, don't move any further. But the second is, wait for the bond markets. Wait for them to solve this problem for us. That is to say, wait for the Russians to recognize that further expansion and further difficulty is hurting their long-term progress. Or, at the very least, let them reform and let the bond markets come in which case they're a more pleasant country to be with in the world anyway. Essentially, the longer we play out the international system's strengths, which are largely financial, the better we are. The more we make this into a visceral issue that could lead to actual conflict, we're basically playing right into the hands of a person who has hard power but no financial or soft power.
So this will segue nicely into a more broad question about foreign relations with Russia. So as I hear you saying it, we can rely partially on these international economic forces to resolve these problems without having to be perhaps overly confrontational about certain issues, and rightly pointing out that there is probably not tremendous American support for military intervention in Ukraine. So several attendees today have asked about foreign relations, and one person has posed this question of, if we're too antagonistic towards Russia, do we need better diplomatic relations? Another person very similarly has asked if there's missed opportunities for the U.S. and Russia to become allies, and I think that's really relevant in relation to your response about Ukraine, right, as well. Sort of, are there missed opportunities despite these big disagreements about important foreign policy issues? And then also questions related to this about the Trump administration and if this deterioration is because we need Russia as an enemy, right, is one of the questions. But related to this also, if Trump capitalized on the American public not wanting a war with Russia in his campaign, as I understand the question, if I'm reading this question correctly. So I think generally about foreign relations and sort of what are the opportunities there? Are we missing something? Is there something that could work better between U.S. foreign relations?
Let me answer the second one first, the question on do we need Russia as an enemy? The answer clearly is no, because we have managed, when the Russians were our partners or erstwhile friends, we found other enemies. Technically, we found them in the Middle East, but more broadly, I think we found them in China. And I think this president has proven, among other things, he's more than willing to have the Chinese be his enemy. So consequently, I don't think that historically we need somebody to focus our animosity towards. It doesn't have to be the Russians at this point. But that leads to the broader question of the Trump administration's foreign policy. And I'm going to make this point as subtly as I can. If you were trying to design a foreign policy whose end goal was the diminution of American prestige and power and strength in the world, you could not have designed a better foreign policy than what Donald Trump has done over the last 18 months. And the reason is because he has eroded the natural advantage that the United States had in the world, which is that we built it, which meant others want to be in it. In essence, we had a lot of allies and a lot of friends. The United States didn't have to impose sanctions because the world community would impose sanctions, whether formal sanctions or, as I've argued already twice today, informally through just the basics of the financial markets in a system, by the way, that we set up. So the thing that the United States should be doing at this time as a broad message of its foreign policy is seeking out like-minded countries and not suggesting that we are going it alone in many ways, but that we are all in this together. Remember, the mantra for the last 60-odd years has been a rising tide raises all ships. And yes, Donald Trump is right that we have spent an inordinate amount of money on security over the last half century plus. I would argue it's a lot less than if we had been in actual war for the last half century plus, and that is, in essence, a good investment. Not a great investment, but a good investment. And consequently, ultimately, what we need is some sort of international way of rallying our strategic power with allies. You know, in the Atlantic, it might be something like NATO. In the Pacific, what we really should get is some kind of strategic and economic and political alliance across the Pacific in which we have other countries that share our liberal economic interests and democratic interests to a large extent that can together work to provide a common front against our broader enemies, such as China. You might refer to this by a catchy name like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it's interesting to note, of course, that Donald Trump yesterday said he's going to rethink the issue of whether or not we should leave the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I don't think he actually will, but what this suggests is that the president perhaps is doing what I think presidents should do, which is learning in office. I suspect that over the last few months, someone has sat him down and explained to him what the Trans-Pacific Partnership actually is. And having finally understood what it actually is, he realizes that's a pretty good thing. It's not the evil undercutting NAFTA-like trade deals he always rails against. It's essentially a cooperative intellectual property rights agreement. That's what we need. And so the president, I hope, is moving in that direction, though I would not bet my last dollar on it.
So related to this as well, there have been a couple of questions about Putin's intentions, sort of Putin's goals in the region, and especially in Europe, because your remarks at the beginning were very much about sort of what's Russia's role in Europe, what is the role of the U.S. in Europe, right? And so we have one question here that was about the Soviet Union, of course, in the 1950s, after the 1950s, if we remember like the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, right? The Soviet Union very much does not withdraw from Hungary, but then later does withdraw in the Gorbachev era from the region. It says sort of Moscow is silent, right, is the word, that they take a step back. And so part of the question here as I read it from one of our attendees is that does the Soviet Union want places like Hungary back? Do they want to reestablish, does Putin want to reestablish a Soviet-style presence in Europe? Does he want to move back in? And related to this, one of the very first questions that came in was whether or not Stalin's really to blame for all this, for the situation today. If we want to go back far enough that Stalin's the one to blame for creating the Soviet system that perhaps informs all the way to today. Maybe it's true. Putin wants to go back in Soviet style into Europe.
You know, it is true that Stalin's popularity has skyrocketed in Russia over the last decade and a half. I'm going to put that in the back of my mind while I answer the first question of whether or not the Russians would like to essentially reestablish an empire in Eastern Europe. I don't think so. I think what their real game is in Europe at this point is anarchy and chaos, by which I mean they recognize that the thing that is most detrimental to them as a somewhat mid-level, mid-range power is a consortium of bigger powers, such as perhaps the European Union or NATO. So anything that they can do to support the dissolution of those institutions or the distrust of those institutions, whether it's through supporting nationalist insurgent political movements that want to pull out of their different organizations, or whether, of course, it's using, shall we say, new cyber techniques to make people question the stability of their own institutions and their own democratic institutions, or whether, and I think here's the most interesting one, whether it's through getting the British to vote themselves out of Brexit. Remember, that vote was remarkably close, and the Russians were remarkably involved. And we may not be wondering, we might be wondering, whether or not their influence changed the American election. I personally have no doubt that their influence changed the Brexit election. So in essence, what Russia's goal is to remember that power itself is always a relative dynamic. That is to say, if you can't increase your power, one way to get closer to your adversaries is by decreasing theirs. And the way to decrease Western Europe's power is through promoting disillusion. And that will allow the Russians a greater sense of power and ultimately a greater sense of control over their near frontier, which I don't think includes Hungary at this point, but does include Southern Caucasus and other areas that were part of the former Soviet Union.
So what do you think about NATO is my next question, building on this.
NATO.
So there have been a couple questions about NATO, and more specifically what I think NATO thinks about Russia and Russia thinks about NATO. It sounds like what you're saying is Putin probably doesn't want to go back in Soviet style into Europe, right? And certainly Hungary is now, they're not going to invade Hungary. They may have close relations with them or not. So what about NATO? One person posed the question about what if Russia had gotten into NATO in 1990, as improbable as that would seem, and it requires us to stretch the limits of NATO's original intention and creation. What if Russia had gotten into NATO, and should Russia be in NATO, was another question.
First, let's remember in many ways why NATO expanded in the 90s and after. First of all, because they were asked. That's important. The Warsaw Pact, Stalin, come back to our good friend Stalin, did not ask the countries of Eastern Europe whether or not they would like Soviet tanks rolling over them. They were pushing back the Germans and happened to be there. NATO, I think, is in places like Hungary and Poland after 1991, they asked to join. And they asked to join because they recognized that NATO isn't just a military institution. It's, if you will, the front of the shield of the democratic world, and that they want to have more stability within their democratic regimes. Now, what's particularly interesting about that point is that we could say, well, if we take those two examples, Hungary and Poland, you could argue very easily right now that, well, one of them has become solidly democratic, and the other we have a few more questions about right now. So it causes us to question the central premise of whether democracy and NATO has to go together. And by the way, you could argue the same thing about Turkey as well. So consequently, I think what NATO needs to do is to remember that it's not there just as a military organization, but as a democracy promoting stability partnership organization. It gets these countries talking together. It gets these countries working together. It's not really about the security guarantee, because if we play our games right, we never have to use the security guarantee. It's about all the 1,001 conversations that occur over the course of the average day between leaders, military and civilian, within NATO countries as they continue to coordinate their moves together. NATO, I think, is actually quite useful in this regard, and this is why, again, I was particularly disheartened by the current president's not only open disdain for NATO in the first few months of his administration, but suggestion that perhaps we would pull out of NATO if they didn't do more to pay their rents. That's not why NATO exists, and the money doesn't matter. Yes, I realize it's hard as Americans to say our tax dollars don't matter, but the truth is, again, everything that we pay for NATO and everything that we pay for our security is a lot cheaper than if another war breaks out in the middle of Europe. So let's create the institutions that make our adversaries not want to push the envelope. That's a lot cheaper than actually having to send troops over even to defend where the envelope begins.
Great. So related to this, so if NATO is more broadly conceived as also promoting democracy, hopefully promoting the right, what we think are the right kinds of politics in countries, there's several questions about domestic politics within Russia. So one broad question was about if there is anything that the U.S. or the West could have done at the end of the Cold War to encourage a democratic state in Russia. And then two related questions about, one about political dissent and how vibrant now dissent in Russia is likely to be, right? So can we encourage democracy in Russia? Is there the hope for political opposition within Russia? And related to this, a very good question about Russians being known to be highly educated, aren't they smart enough to know that their news is state-controlled, right? So I think these related questions about promoting democracy in Russia, where the opposition stands, and don't they know the Kremlin is feeding them these lines?
You know, when I get a free steak, I don't ask where it comes from. And so, yes, I think the people in Russia are aware of the control of the media. But by the way, we have a lot of control of our media in our own country today, and that's a big issue. So the truth of the matter is, no matter how many times you say to yourself, I want to try to find other news sources, A, it's difficult, and B, if the news is something I enjoy hearing because it's good news, I'm unlikely to change the channel no matter how educated I am. The second thing is about, the first question was?
So there were three questions. One was about promoting democracy at the end of the Cold War. Yes. One was dissent, and one was, don't they know the media's control?
Again, I'll answer those in reverse order. The question of promoting democracy, I'm actually not a big fan of democracy promotion. I don't think it necessarily is helpful. I don't think that we can tell other countries what to do. I am a big fan of democracy example. That is to say, if we really want the world to be more like us, we shouldn't try to make it more like us. We should try to make ourselves better. And therefore, they'll want to be more like us. And if we are a strong institution and we are prosperous and we are stable, that's the best poster you could have for democracy. And I think that's actually more effective in many ways than cheering on other dissident groups that may or may not have power. And by the way, other dissident groups we found around the world that may or may not be useful after they come into power to our interests. What we need to play again is the long game here, the stream of history, as Bismarck used to talk about it. See where the future is going and try to ride the stream as peacefully as you can. If we really still believe that the world is moving in an open, democratic, globalized way, let's stay on that course and be the lead ship rather than trying to, if you will, pull other countries along with us. On the issue of, God, I can't believe I forgot the first part of the question again.
Was it the opposition? Was it opposition in Russia?
No, about whether or not we could have done anything. This is a question I really puzzle over, because Russia was going to go through a terrible time in the 1990s, no matter what. And remember in the early 1990s, when there was discussion of whether or not we should start a new Marshall Plan for Eastern Europe or a new Marshall Plan for the post-Soviet economy, remember, this is the same period that we head into a recession. So first of all, there's not a lot of money there. But second of all, what's really fascinating, and this is from the documents that we've gotten revealed just in the last few years, is that in all the G7 countries, the most important industrialized countries, led at this time by the United States, the same basic economic analysis came, whether it's in Germany, whether it's in Britain, whether it's in France, whether it's in Japan, whether it's the United States. And the economic calculation was, things are going to get terribly bad in Russia. No amount of money in the world can keep things from getting terribly bad in Russia. If we send money to Russia, it is wasted money because things are going to get bad in Russia and we can't help. Better to have them crash, if you will, quickly and then come out quickly rather than, if you will, let's pull the Band-Aid quick, if you will. I puzzle over this. I wonder over this, because I think you can make a very good argument that had we done more, by the way, I don't think we had the money to do more, but had we done more, perhaps that would have at least engendered better feelings from the Russian people. I got to tell you, I think the power of the basic political argument that our problems are their fault is simply too powerful in our country to avoid, in many cases, and too powerful for most countries to avoid. And therefore, any level of problem within Russia in the 1990s, when perhaps we might have had a great deal of influence, was more easily countered by those who either wanted to go back or wanted to find an enemy for the current problems. So could we have done more? Yes. Would it have made a difference? I don't think so.
So there's another very salient topic that we have not gotten to yet, which is Trump and Putin. And so there's a question about how does the Trump-Putin relationship factor into this? What do they get from each other? I think probably related to the comment you're just making about each country, there's a powerful story here about let's find somebody else to blame for our problems. But what does Trump gain? What does Putin gain? And I think your comments broadly on this would be appreciated.
So far be it from me to try to figure out what's in Donald Trump's mind. We can all spend a lot of time asking a lot of different questions on a lot of different issues. But I have to say, I'm hesitant to use any kind of declarative. I don't want to say of all the things that have astounded me, because I'll immediately think of another one for Donald Trump. But one of the things that has astounded me most for this president has been his reaction to Putin. Because were I advising him, either as a strategist or as a political advisor, I would say your biggest domestic issue right now is that people are concerned about the integrity of your administration, highlighted by something to do with Russia. We all know, everybody in the American government except the president has conceded that the Russians tried to mess with the election. There is something going on with Russia that is being investigated either by the FBI or by the district attorneys or by the special prosecutor. The point of this is the word Russia is associated in a negative context with your administration every day. My reaction, therefore, my advice would be embrace that and be the biggest hawk you can be on Russia. Make a national television address that says our intelligence people have told us that the Russians messed with our election and we are going to get to the bottom of this. And I'm not going to comment on anything about my campaign because that might taint the investigation. I have full faith and confidence in the investigators and in our intelligence community to find the real answer. And I want to find the answer why Russia is a problem. Why hasn't the president done that? One answer could be he doesn't have good political strategists advising him, and I'm not available. The second could be he doesn't want to. Now, here's a really good puzzle. Why does he care so much about creating good relations with a mid-level country while he's antagonizing bigger and bigger countries like China or like our Western European allies over trade and over tariffs? What does he gain from having Russia be negatively associated with him by putting his arms around Putin, by only in the last week, by my recollection and by my count, openly criticizing Putin ever? I can't figure that out. There is no good reason for that. Let me stress that again. There is no good reason for that. There are potentially lots of bad reasons, to which I will say other people more qualified than me are currently investigating them.
So related to this, I think it would be useful to have a comparison with another U.S. president's relationship with Trump. One of the questions that came in was about Ronald Reagan, and if Reagan played a role in the dissolution of the USSR. And so I think there's a nice historical, you're a historian, there's a nice historical contrast potentially between U.S. presidents have had very different relations with Russia. And so did Reagan play a role in the dissolution of the USSR? And then, you know, what kind of contrast is this, how American presidents have tended to relate to Russia, which seems to be unique in the present era?
Well, historically, going back, I think actually Donald Trump's affection for Russia is a historical anomaly. Most Cold War presidents were not particularly fond of Russia, which is what made Reagan so interesting and so unique, because he changed his mind on the Russians in many ways. But here is a place where I have to do that awful thing that I hate it when people do, which is to say, you know, I talk about that a lot in the book. Because Reagan, I think, is really fundamentally misunderstood, and as a consequence, we have drawn the wrong lesson as Americans from the end of the Cold War. Because if I were to ask this quite highly educated, intelligent room of historically minded people, as you walked in, who won the Cold War, the answer would either be we did or Ronald Reagan did. And then if I push a little further on that second category, I say, well, how did Ronald Reagan do it? The answer would be, well, he upped military spending and strained the Soviets to where they realized they couldn't compete. He upped the moral indignation and strained the Soviets to where they realized their system was not keeping up. And in essence, he cast out the Soviets onto, as he put it, the ash heap of history. The story I told you earlier demonstrates the fallacy of this argument, which is that the Soviets had already come to all those conclusions in the 1970s, before Reagan began his evil empire rhetoric or military buildup. So Reagan, if you will, got it right about the Soviets, but he was not the causal agent. In fact, the way I like to describe this is that Reagan is like the guy who commands the sun to rise, and when it rises, takes credit. So he's right that it's going to rise. He was right that the Soviet Union was going to collapse. Let's give him that credit. Did he, and by extension we, outspend the Soviets into the ground? No. At least not in the short term. The only way we did that is to go back to 1946 and George Kennan and the whole idea of containment, which is to say Kennan argued in 1946 that the Soviet economy has structural problems. Give it enough time. I don't know, he said at the time, maybe about 44 years, it'll collapse. He was pretty good in predictions. That, I think, is where we have to remember that we are not omnipotent as Americans. We can play a role, but what really matters is what's going on within other countries. The reason the Soviets changed was because of a recognition that they needed to change, not because we made them realize that. Now, I have to give Reagan credit for being willing to change his rhetoric and being willing to deal with the Russians. But one interesting other thing about Russians, deal with the Russians in a more friendly way than he had at the end of his term than he did by the beginning of had at the end of, beginning of his term. But there's one other interesting thing about Reagan. When we think about Reagan and Gorbachev and the end of the Cold War, I'm going to bet there's one phrase above all that leaps to mind for you, and that is trust but verify. I have to tell you, Gorbachev got sick of Reagan telling him this. So sick at one point during their last meeting, he literally turned to the translator and said, doesn't he know anything else in Russian? So the bigger issue, I think, is that Reagan trusted before he verified, which is actually a very interesting lesson when we think about problems like North Korea, problems like Iran, that if we want to hold up Reagan, I would not. But if one in the United States wants to hold up Reagan as an exemplar of how to run a foreign policy, let's remember that the first thing he did was extend a hand of friendship once he saw an enemy that also was extending a hand. He didn't make them concede before he said he'll talk to them. He didn't, by the way, verify anything that they were doing. He said that'll play out over time.
So we're coming down to our last set of questions here. Before we do that, I do want to make an important announcement very quickly. It mentioned the CWA 70th crowdfunding campaign. So to celebrate the CWA's 70th year, they've set a goal to raise $70,000. They're a quarter of the way to the goal, and they would appreciate your support. Any amount helps. So you can give by selecting the donate button in your app or by visiting the CWA website. So I'd encourage you to check that out. And I'm now going to do a very unfair thing to Jeffrey Engel. We really appreciate having you here today, but I'm going to very unfairly sort of give you several things that you can comment on, and then sort of a closing big question, because we just have a few minutes left, is my understanding. But several people ask about something you mentioned at the end, sort of the foreign relations issue. There were a couple of questions about Syria and comments about that, if you believe the chemical weapons charges against Syria, what that means for U.S.-Russian relations. There was a question about relations with the U.K. and the Skripal poisoning case. Also Iran and Korea, which just came up. And so if you'd like to comment on any of those foreign relations issues, that would be great. And there was one very good question that I was going to close with, so I'm going to go ahead and do it still, which is based on the title of the panel, sort of, I guess, in the context of foreign relations, Russia's foreign relations, Syria, Iran, Korea, If Russia's lost, how can it be found?
If Russia's lost, we should stop looking for it, and we should ask them to find their own flashlight, because we can't control that, and that's the most important issue. And I would take all those critical foreign policy questions you just raised, each of which, of course, would be the subject of multiple panels, and ask you, as you consider each of them, to ask the following question. What is our goal? I think our goal at this point in history should be to keep bad things from happening. So every day that we're not at war with North Korea, I count as a good day. Every day that we're not at war with Iran, I count as a good day. There are other structural factors over time that have kept rogue states from doing things that are existentially dangerous, because it's a greater existential danger to them than to us. Remember, we're worried, let's not put too fine a point on this. We are worried about the North Koreans potentially launching less than a handful of missiles. Every naval vessel that we have in the Pacific has more nuclear weapons on it than the North Koreans have. Think about that and think, are they really going to do something crazy? I don't think they are. Same with Syria. What is our goal here? I think our goal is to keep the problem, A, from getting bigger, and B, to think about the world we want to have going forward. I don't think that we can create a time machine and go back to the origins of the Syrian civil war and keep it from blowing up. What can we do? We can try to minimize the crisis. We can try to keep it from escalating. And this is going to sound like a weenie argument, but I think it's really quite important. We can make sure that international norms are upheld, whether it's the international norms of human rights or, in this specific case, the international prohibition against the use of chemical weapons. We don't want that vestige of World War I to go away. So here is a place where we perhaps, if it is true, and I think it is, that the Syrians or their allies use chemical weapons, I would recommend reacting. I would not recommend a pinpoint strike, and I would not recommend an invasion, somewhere in between the two. The real thing that should worry us, and I'll end on this, is the President of the United States has, according to multiple independent news sources, lied an average of 6 times a day since he's been in office. Why does this matter? Well, it actually matters less for the fact than what we think of him than what it means about what we think about what he says when he's telling the truth, or in how can you tell? Because we now have a question in the world, not just in the United States, but in the world, where America and its allies are about to come to the conclusion that, yes, we have somewhat definitive evidence that the Syrians actually use chemical weapons. Have you looked at the evidence? No. Have I looked at the evidence? No. My faith in that statement comes from the full faith and credit of the person standing at the podium at the White House. The world has less faith in his statements than it did before he was taken off, before he took office. That should concern us most of all.
Well, on that note, on
Happy
that very
note.
Dour yeah. note, thank you very much for this
Thank
panel.
You all. It was a wonderful conference.
Very interesting.